A group of migrants traveling from Central America reaches the U.S. border over the weekend while the country watches.
I've heard they don't give asylum anymore, that the U.S. isn't helping anyone, that it's a lie, that they're going to deport me.
The president zeroes in on the migrants. We zero in on asylum and how the system deals with their claims. And in California, authorities caught an accused serial killer through an ancestry DNA database. But what does it mean for privacy, not just for you, but your descendants?
That person is making a very important decision for generations to come, their children, their children's children, and that's to expose their genetic code to the public at large.
This is The Takeaway for Monday, April 30th, 2018.
Are you watching that mess that's going on right now with the caravan coming up? Are you watching this?
Over the weekend, on Saturday night, President Trump gave a rally in Washington Township, Michigan. He covered a lot of topics from the Russia investigation to Hillary Clinton to immigration and the president's impression of how the asylum system works.
If a person puts their foot over the line, we have to take them into our country. We have to register them. We then have to ask them a couple of questions. Lawyers are telling them what to say, how unsafe they are. And once they say that, we have to let them go to come back to court in like a year. Only one problem. They don't come back. Okay, that's the end.
President Trump at his rally in Michigan on Saturday. On Sunday, between Tijuana and California, about 200 migrants reached the United States border seeking asylum. Now, many of them are now waiting on the Mexico side of the border, but so far, none have been processed by U.S. officials. They're part of a caravan of Central American migrants, mostly from Honduras and El Salvador, and their trip has become international news because the president has been tweeting and talking about it.
And the laws are so corrupt. They're so corrupt. And you know, one of the reasons they do it is because the Democrats actually feel, and they're probably right, that all of these people that are pouring across are going to vote for Democrats. They're not going to vote for Republicans. They're going to vote no matter what we do. They're going to vote. So there is a theory that they do it for that. They do it for a lot of reasons. A lot of times they don't even know what they're doing.
Well, the people in that caravan are not United States voters, nor do they have any tangible prospect of becoming voters in the near future. But who are the people who make up the caravan, and how exactly will U.S. officials deal with them at the border between the United States and Mexico? That's where we start today on The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Jean Guerrero is investigative Fronteras reporter for KPBS in San Diego, has been traveling with the caravan, and was there on Sunday at the border. Jean, welcome.
Hey, Todd. Great to be here.
And great to have you, Jean. You've been spending time with the migrants in this caravan as they reach the border between the United States and Mexico. You heard the president's description of this caravan and what they're up to when they seek asylum. Does it match up with what you've seen?
Well, most of the people in the caravan are families, particularly women and children. And all of the ones who I've spoken with have said that they're coming to the United States to seek asylum because they're fleeing violence. Most of them are coming from Honduras, where a very divisive presidential election late last year has led to killings in the streets. A lot of these women expressed fear to me about wanting to keep their children safe. That's one common theme that just keeps coming up again and again, is their desire to keep their children safe, and that's why they've come to the U.S.-Mexico border. So, I mean, it was kind of not a big surprise what ended up happening yesterday. They arrived at the San Ysidro Port of Entry, but even though they were all intending to seek asylum, they had heard the president's comments. So when they arrived and were told that the San Ysidro Port of Entry had reached capacity and that the ports could no longer accept any more people, at least for the time being, it wasn't a big surprise. One of the women who I'd spoken with earlier, Jamie Pastora Castro, who came with her 2-year-old baby, she told me earlier in the trip that she was scared about this happening.
Y aquí sí nos dijeron que no daban asilo. Estados Unidos no está ayudando. Eso es mentira, dice Estados Unidos.
I've heard they don't give asylum anymore, that the U.S. isn't helping anyone, that it's a lie, that they're going to deport me.
Now, Jean, that's the word that's reached this one migrant that you spoke to. You said that they were told that the San Ysidro officials were at capacity. So what's going on with the migrants who are there at the border now?
So if anything, they'll be allowed to trickle through as space becomes available. I haven't gotten confirmation from U.S. Customs and Border Protection whether they have any new members of the caravan in custody. But last I heard is that they were going to be waiting because the entire group got turned away once they arrived. They marched in the afternoon. It was a really interesting scene because there was Mexican federal police, the Mexican army was there, Mexican immigration officials, and stopped the entire group in their tracks and said, if anyone wants to enter the U.S., it's going to have to be a very small group of people. But as the group had already heard from U.S. Customs and Border Protection, the port was at capacity. But so they allowed a very small group to approach the port of entry. And there they were told what they already knew, which is that they weren't going to be processing any more people for the time being.
So, Jean, these caravans aren't new. They do happen relatively frequently through Mexico to the United States border. But one thing that's different this time from the past is that now the president of the United States is tweeting about them, is talking about them. You've said that they've heard that message. These migrants are famous now in a way I'm sure they didn't want to be when they started this journey. How has that affected the trip?
I mean, it's crazy. I mean, it's sort of, there's a sense that the whole mission of the caravan has sort of backfired. I mean, nobody has said that out loud, but there is a sense of, oh my gosh, this has all kind of gotten out of our hands, because these caravans have been happening for over a decade, and their point is to raise awareness, to call attention to the plight of asylum seekers and the violence in Central America. But this year, it seems that the attention that they've grabbed is not the positive attention that they were hoping for. Yeah. So, and I spoke to an attorney, Nicole Ramos, who was one of the attorneys who provided training to these asylum seekers about their rights.
We've been very clear that those who are coming to the border are coming to a port of entry to seek asylum at a port of entry, as they are permitted to do under existing U.S. federal law and international law.
And she just kept saying over and over again, I mean, it is their right to enter the United States, and we're going to wait out here until that happens.
Jean Guerrero, investigative Fronteras reporter for KPBS in San Diego. Jean, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, let's go to one expert now who takes a skeptical view of the asylum claims we're watching at the California-Mexico border. Andrew Arthur is a resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies and a former immigration judge in York, Pennsylvania. And in his eyes, the asylum system is vulnerable to claims of a fear of persecution when most migrants are really coming to the U.S. for economic opportunities.
Well, there are a couple of different things, Todd, that make this migrant caravan a little bit different. One, it's larger than in previous years. And in fact, news reports have indicated that the organizers of the caravan were surprised at the size of the caravan. It was about 1,000 people, I believe, at the time that they were in Tapachula in southern Mexico. And it grew to 1,500, I believe, by the time that they got to Puebla. But it has dissipated a bit, or people have scattered. The other issue with respect to this particular year and this particular caravan is that the caravan occurred at the same time that we saw a huge spike in both apprehensions of individuals entering illegally and apprehensions of aliens who were deemed inadmissible at the ports of entry. More than 50,000 applicants for admission and those who had entered illegally were apprehended in the month of March, which was well up from just over 14,000 in April of 2017. So we've seen the numbers tick up significantly. And the caravan is more of a bellwether for the increase in the number of individuals entering illegally than it is an issue within and of itself.
So it's a very busy time at the border, to be sure, and the numbers probably show that. But people coming to the border to claim asylum is certainly nothing new. What's wrong with it in this case for people to arrive and claim asylum and then let U.S. officials vet their claims like they do every day at border crossings all over the place?
Well, there are a variety of issues. The first one is the fact that Mexico, the country through which most of these individuals are passing, they're not the majority are not Mexican nationals themselves, is itself an asylum-granting country, and they take that role very seriously. They do it in conjunction with UNHCR. So if individuals are truly in fear of harm from their home countries, they can actually go to Mexico and apply for asylum there. But it doesn't appear that the individuals who have shown up in San Ysidro or in Tijuana have actually done that. The other issue is that there are a number of loopholes in the immigration laws right now that facilitate not only the entry of these individuals, but in fact, the release into the community. And for that reason, it brings to light those loopholes and indicates some flaws in American law that need to be addressed.
Andrew, I think the difficulty here is presuming motivation on the part of any individual asylum seeker and sort of evaluating them en masse as maybe moving to abuse a system that might let them through. I mean, don't each of their cases have to be evaluated individually? That's the law, right?
Each of their cases rise and fall on their own merits. But look at the numbers. 75 to 90% of all individuals claiming credible fear are found to have credible fear, and most of those people are coming from the Northern Triangle countries of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, or alternatively from Mexico. But once in immigration court, the denial rate is extremely high. Between 2012 and 2017, the denial rate for Mexico was 88%. For El Salvador, it was 79%. For Honduras, it was 78%. For Guatemala, it was 75%. As Attorney General Jeff Sessions noted in a speech that he gave to the Executive Office for Immigration Review back in October of 2017, almost half of these individuals never end up filing asylum claims once they're found to have credible fear, and many of them just disappear into the United States. So yes, they do have the right, and each of these cases rise and fall on their own merits. But the fact is, at the end of the day, most of these cases are denied, one and two. As I noted previously, they've passed through a asylum-granting country, Mexico, 1,000 miles through Mexico in order to reach the border of the United States. And in fact, these individuals didn't even go to the closest border, which would have been down in Brownsville, Matamoros. Instead, they went all the way to Tijuana, which is a good distance from the Guatemalan border, in order to claim asylum there.
So, Andrew, what do you then suspect is going on here? It sounds like you have a lot of skepticism that the people in this caravan, most of them anyway, have legitimate asylum claims, and they might be hoping to overwhelm a system and then disappear somewhere into America. What exactly do you suspect is their motivation?
And let me clarify that, Todd. The fact is that, you know, there is a lot of crime. There's a lot of gang violence in these countries. And, you know, individuals, you know, just like you and I would, if given the opportunity, we would move out of a crime-ridden area to a safer area, to a country that has the rule of law, to a country that has, you know, a strong education system and a good healthcare system, if we could. But the fact is that most of those claims at the end of the day just aren't claims that are recognized by American immigration law. So, you know, the fact is they are making both a asylum choice, and they're making an economic choice to come to the United States rather than remaining in Mexico, applying for asylum there and going through the system there.
Still, the hundreds of people leaving Tijuana through San Ysidro towards San Diego today in that caravan, their asylum claims will rise and fall, as you say, on their own merits, correct?
That is correct. And again, you know, having been a judge, I would never prejudge any of those claims without knowing what they are.
Andrew Arthur, resident fellow of law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies and a former immigration judge. Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick. We're learning a lot more now about how police in California were able to track down Joseph James DeAngelo, the suspected Golden State Killer. And one big piece of the puzzle here is a genetic database not too different from the popular genealogy databases that let people find out about their family origins or relatives. Now, if you haven't used one of these services, you have probably heard some of the ads.
I decided to have my DNA tested through Ancestry DNA.
Getting my 23andMe results,
it really opened my eyes.
The big surprise was we're not German at all.
The more you know about your DNA,
the more you know about yourself.
Now, these services are familiar, but police seem to have come up with a brand new use for genealogy databases. And though catching killers is definitely a good thing, it raises questions about just what information you might be giving away when you send in your DNA. Aaron Murphy is a law professor at NYU and author of Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA. And she told me exactly how law enforcement used genealogy databases to find Joseph James DeAngelo.
in-house, the forensic laboratory people in California made a profile using what are called SNPs. It's just little pieces of the DNA in every person that gets passed along as you move through inheritance generations. And so they used probably, you know, hundreds of thousands of these SNPs. That's the standard in forensic genealogy. And they made a file that looked a lot like the files you would get if you just sent your material, your genetic material, off to be tested commercially. And then they uploaded that to a website where people share these file results with one another, and the website sort of tells them what the linkages are between people.
So investigators kind of made a patchwork DNA profile of their suspect. They uploaded it. But then what happened next? Because something has to happen on the other end to get a match.
So my understanding, and again, this is just from what I've been reading, and I don't have any inside knowledge, but my understanding is they found at least a relative, it seems like a second cousin or something, and they traced up to a great-great-grandfather, and then they essentially went and mapped out the family tree, trying to use public information to rule out people who probably wouldn't be the suspect because of, say, the wrong age, the wrong gender, the wrong geographic location. So given that, you know, publicly it's been reported that they found a great-great-grandfather, I think it's safe to assume they really fully mapped this tree, trying to find someone in California who would fit the profile that they had of the killer.
So investigators have also said that they used a website called GED Match that's different from 23andMe, from Ancestry, from these commercial DNA testing services that are so very popular. What is that, and how did investigators use it?
That's the site they uploaded the DNA to. So GEDmatch is a site that essentially tries to take advantage of all these different sites and what they offer. So if you want to test at 23andMe and they do their proprietary testing and they'll tell you what they have in their database, you can only get as far as their database. If your relative that you're trying to find happened to test at Ancestry.com and your other relative happened to test at FamilyTree.com or FamilyTreeDNA or some other vendor, you won't cross-communicate. Those vendors aren't looking in each other's databases. So what GEDmatch was an attempt by just two guys, from what I understand, to create an alternative that would allow people to compare across these different vendor platforms. So you could download your raw data from one of the sites that you had used, upload it again to this GEDmatch site, and then GEDmatch created a way for whatever overlapping parts of the genome were looked at to be compared across these different services and kind of amplify the size of the people that you're looking at.
When millions of people signed up for 23andMe or Ancestry, did they necessarily know that there was a third service out there that can cull all of this data and mix it around?
Well, to be clear, the only people who, if you signed up for one of those other sites, then your genetic material would not be on GEDmatch just because you signed up for that site. Those servers are not feeding GEDmatch data. It's only if you then downloaded your data from the site you signed up with and re-uploaded it to this other site that you would be there. But your question really points to something incredibly important, which is that one member in a very extended family tree who says, you know, I don't care about privacy or genetic schmenetics, you know, I just want to know whether I'm related to some celebrity, that person is making a very important decision for not only the rest of their living family members, but really for generations to come, their children, their children's children, and that's to expose their genetic code to the public at large. And I do think that at this time, you know, not only is that a serious decision in terms of law enforcement, but that's going to be a serious decision for other reasons as well. We are really in the earliest stages of understanding the genome. You know, how would you feel if 20 years, 30 years, 40 years from now, the genome gave us indications like, what's the average intelligence of your family line? Are you likely to develop certain diseases insurers might not want to insure? Are you, you know, prone to violence, prone to addiction, prone to mental health issues? There are some people who might say, yeah, I really want to know that information. I want to know it for myself, or I want to know it for my children. But do you want it publicly available for every employer or prospective date or, you know, insurer to be able to look at and know? And I think that's the kind of decision making that worries me. You know, even above law enforcement, this is pretty powerful material. That's why, you know, literally thousands of researchers around the world are trying to unlock the code, the secret to the genome. And just because we haven't fully unlocked it yet doesn't mean that 20 years from now, 30 years from now, we're not going to know a lot more about what our genes say.
So, Professor Murphy, look, I think that there's almost no one who would think that catching D'Angelo isn't a good thing. And a lot of people would say, however you got to get him, go ahead and get them. But overall, do you think this is a positive development, the way police have figured out how to use publicly available databases to catch a killer here?
I don't. I agree with you 100%. And it's really hard to have that internal struggle where you think, the closure for the victims, the justice that's finally being delivered to this person, you know, it's really hard not to find that incredibly appealing and to be thrilled that finally that someone's being held accountable for these crimes. But I do think we need a much more protective set of regulations and laws around the scope of genetic information. I think we're really operating in a no man's land right now. A lot of consumers may not have the expertise to really think forward to what the information they're sharing means. Right now, some of these companies, if they were to go bankrupt, they could, in theory, sell their genetic data. We've already seen examples of people contributing to what they believed were anonymous research projects, and then their data in turn gets sold to a for-profit company and used for law enforcement purposes. This has already happened, and, someone might say, I thought it was anonymous. I thought it was for, medical research, or I was trying to be a, kind of good member of my community, and now I'm finding out that it's being used for this criminal justice purpose. So I think there needs to be a lot more regulation, a lot more oversight. And I do think this is powerful information that people should be able to access and able to engage in without, worrying about these larger downstream consequences.
Professor Erin Murphy of NYU, author of Inside the Cell, The Dark Side of Forensic DNA. Erin Murphy, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
What do you think? Should law enforcement be using genealogy databases to catch criminals, or does it raise too many privacy concerns?
This is Carol Dodson from Tarrytown, New York, and I have no concern at all. If I'm doing DNA testing, I don't care if it goes into a database. I'm not concerned about privacy issues at all if it helps to catch and convict criminals.
Hi, I'm Donna from Kenosha. I've used Ancestry for my family tree and to help determine if an adoptee was related, and she was. She was a first cousin. I'm concerned that my DNA could be used by insurance companies, and this information, in my opinion, should be completely private.
This is Kimo from Pittsburgh. No, I'm not concerned, since I'm not the Golden State Killer. Now, I do not want my DNA used against me to deny me a job, insurance, or anything else. And I don't want it released publicly. But I don't mind if the database of which I'm a part is used by the authorities with proper judicial oversight to find violent criminals.
And we got this from DeSoto, Texas. Gattaca is here. The notion there is any sort of privacy these days is a farce. We pretend to be outraged and shocked at certain events, but continue to willingly give away our private information.
You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. If you like what you're hearing, give us a rating and review us on iTunes. Also, tell your friends. Share this podcast on Facebook or Twitter or wherever you want your followers to get some solid news coverage. They'll be smarter. They'll think you're a hero. It's a win-win. All right, now back to the show.
Deadly protests are unraveling Nicaragua. At least 40 people have been killed during student-led demonstrations that started 2 weeks ago, according to the Nicaraguan Center for Human Rights. Protesters took to the streets after President Daniel Ortega ordered reforms to the nation's social security system, and then they clashed with security forces. Now protests have erupted nationwide. Francis Robles is covering the situation for the New York Times in Nicaragua. Francis, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Francis, bring us up to date, if you would, on the latest on these protests.
Well, what you're seeing now is that the protests are getting gigantic. I mean, tens and tens of thousands of people, except that the government has realized that it had made a terrible mistake in trying to repress them, so that they are taking place in a very peaceful manner. There was a large one on Saturday sponsored by the Catholic Church. The other really important thing that's happening is that, it's important to remember that a lot of people got shot. They were in the hospital. People are dying. People are still dying. So that death toll is continuing to climb.
The death toll from the initial clashes that you talked to us about before the weekend, or does violence continue? You said these protests have grown in number and are largely peaceful. Do violent clashes continue?
No, the violent clashes are not continuing. So it's the death toll from the original 3 or 4 days of protests, including a few from the tail ends of looting and things of that nature. Bodies showed up in morgues, you know, in the middle of last week. And so people that were missing are now being discovered dead, and people who were in the intensive care unit died.
So these protests started with university students protesting changes to the social security net and into pensions. But now you say they've really spread across Nicaraguan society.
The social security has pretty much nothing to do with it anymore. I mean, for one thing, the government rescinded its decree making people have to contribute more and receive less. Now people really want the resignation of the president or early elections or just a systematic overhaul to the democratic institutions of this country so that they can feel confident that when elections are held in Nicaragua, that they're fair and they're transparent. And so the big thing that's going to be happening in the coming days are negotiations with the government to try to make that happen. I don't see the government agreeing to early elections, but that's the big question. You know, how much of these demands will they be agreeable to?
And who's doing the negotiating? Francis, you pointed out when you were with us last week that the protest movement doesn't have an identifiable leader, doesn't have one person who embodies the demands of the protesters, and doesn't have a single person or group of people who could do the negotiating.
They're in the process now of picking those people. So the Catholic Church is taking a very big leadership role. There's an auxiliary bishop named Silvio Baez who has emerged as almost like a celebrity leader in all of this. He's very harsh against the government. He's very trusted by the people of Nicaragua. So he'll be there. And then you're going to have different factions represented. So civil society, women's organizations, labor organizations, the student movement. So the part that you're seeing kind of the leadership vacuum, you know, kind of big question mark, is among the students, because the students are the ones that really brought Nicaragua to this point. They made this happen. And so they are demanding serious representation. And so how many should it be? Who should it be? Those are the things that they're sorting out really now.
Protests in Nicaragua spread to mass society as protesters might be on the cusp of major changes with the government of President Daniel Ortega. Francis Robles with the New York Times in Nicaragua. Francis, thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega was hailed as a revolutionary when he led the Sandinista National Liberation Front and ousted the Somoza government back in 1979. Ortega led the country during the U.S.-backed Contra Revolution, which resulted in the deaths of more than 30,000 Nicaraguans. He then lost the presidential election in 1990 and was then reelected in 2006. Stephen Kinzer is a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International and Public Affairs at Brown University. Stephen, welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, this latest crisis seemed to start with protests about Social Security and the social safety net. Students protested. Government police responded with a violent crackdown, and then things spiraled. What's behind this crisis, in your view?
You're quite right to point out that the spark that set off these protests, which was a change in pension rules, was not the real cause. There's been an accumulation of grievances over a period of years that have been just brought to a boil by this last crisis. It starts with the decision of Daniel Ortega to remain in power indefinitely and to use the institutions of state to legitimize his permanent rule by not allowing dissent and opposition to emerge through normal, peaceful political channels. He has made it likely, and as it has now happened, that opposition will explode in some violent way. He has some experience with this, of course, and that has been a long tradition in Nicaraguan history. But we're now seeing again this phenomenon of the peaceful road to change or opposition or alternating leadership closed, and that then leading to a violent explosion.
Now, a long simmer behind what's boiling over now. Of course, Daniel Ortega was on the other side of a battle with authoritarian parties back in the 70s when he was a leader of the Sandinistas and challenged the Somoza government. But is this the first test for Daniel Ortega's authority in this way by Nicaraguan people?
It's not the first test, but it's certainly the first one at this level. I think you're now seeing the first widespread public expression that there's true discontent, not just about individual policies that Ortega is following, but by the very fact of his permanence in power. And it's difficult to see how that resentment is going to go away, since Ortega obviously is determined to remain in power as long as he can. Right now, you don't see an opposition leadership that's united to emerge as an alternative, but this has to be taken as the strongest reprimand to Ortega since he came to power.
Now, you say that Daniel Ortega seems to have lost touch with everyday Nicaraguans. He wouldn't be the first leader to suffer from that affliction, but why do you say that in his case?
Ortega's quite isolated. He's not out in public much. His wife is the one who is the public face of government. Although he retains a certain popularity, I think she has less popularity, including within the Sandinista Front itself. I think also that in Ortega's mind, he's looking back at the authoritarian style of Nicaraguan government that was in power when he was growing up. This was all he knew, the Somoza dictatorship. And although it wasn't so clear at the time that he helped lead the revolution against the Somoza dictatorship, I think you can now see that his life experience growing up in an authoritarian state in which one person decided everything decisively shaped him. He is now going back to the default mechanism of government that surrounded him when he grew up. We now see that his revolution was actually quite partial, and in many ways he's reverting back to the political system that he rebelled against when he was a young man.
Stephen Kinzer, Brown University, thank you so much.
Good to be with you.
So, do you want to reach us here at The Takeaway? There's a few good ways to do it. The first is on our Facebook page. Post comments there and keep up with the news of the day by following us. We're on Twitter also, at The Takeaway. And you can call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Let's go to Washington State now, where the death of a 20-year-old has strained the already frayed relationship between a Native American community there and law enforcement. ProPublica reporting fellow Rahima Nassa tells us about the crime at the heart of this story.
So last year, Jimmy Smith Kramer, who is a member of the Quinault Indian Nation, which is the small Indian reservation on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State, he went to this local campsite along Donkey Creek Road, which is a really popular site for locals in the area, both non-native and native. And he gathered there that night in late May to celebrate his birthday with a few close friends. You know, they were all drinking and having a good time when this white pickup truck pulled over. There was a back and forth, and then the truck suddenly reverses. And Jimmy, he dives into the way of the truck to get his friend out of the way, but he ends up getting the worst of it. And then the truck moves forward again as it tries to leave the area and crushes him one more time.
That back and forth that Rahima Nassa describes there may have included the driver yelling racial slurs. Rahima's been writing about this case as part of the Documenting Hate Project at ProPublica, and she says the driver of the car was ultimately caught and charged with manslaughter. But prosecutors here decided not to pursue hate crimes charges in the case of Jimmy's death, despite some witnesses who said they heard racial epithets. And that was a painful decision for this community in particular.
One of the witnesses claims that she had heard war whoops. And then two other witnesses claim that they heard a variety of other racial slurs before the attack. The investigators, they spent weeks, months really diving into the case and trying to figure out what actually happened, who said what. The investigators couldn't match up the stories. There were over a dozen people there. Most of those people said that they actually didn't hear any racial slurs.
You went through the police interviews with witnesses, with the other kids that were there when Jimmy Smith Kramer was killed.
Mm-hmm.
What did you find?
This case was just so complicated. For one, the witness who heard the war whoops, she wrote that in her witness statement, and they questioned her about it three times, and then oddly enough, toward the end, she conceded her statement after the detective asked her if the war whoop sounded like a Sasquatch, which is, you know, a fictional creature. And then the other two witnesses, they heard these really terrible things before the incident, which I can't say on the radio. I spoke to them too, and they said, well, I don't think that I was really hurt a lot because I'm just a kid. Not to say that they shouldn't base the entire investigation on these three people, but just pointing out this was complicated, this was tricky, and still acknowledge the concerns the community has had.
What penalty did he receive for running over Jimmy Smith Kramer?
He was charged with manslaughter in the first degree and two counts of vehicular assault, one for killing Jimmy Smith Kramer and the other for injuring the other victim.
So it looks like the justice system is going toward accountability here for the driver of this truck. But you're talking about a community that's hurt and disappointed because the additional charges, the additional implications of a hate crime just weren't pursued here. What does that mean to them?
This case definitely opened up a lot of old wounds. For instance, in Washington State during the 60s and 70s, there was a series of civil disobedience protests known as the Fish Wars, where Native fishermen were asserting their right to fish in traditional waters, and they were constantly shot at and attacked for their treaty right to fish in the waters they've fished in for generations. And then even more recently, in 2013, the Quinault Nation sued four local school districts for discriminating against their athletes. In the suit, they claimed that their students were subjected to all sorts of racial slurs. The local school districts dissolved their athletics league with them, so the students couldn't play against each other. And this actually happened when Jimmy was in high school, and it really affected his game and his opportunities for college scholarships. And so after his death, it just felt like another sting for this community.
Well, I want to bring in Barbara Perry now. Professor Perry is a professor of social science and humanities at the University of Ontario Institute of Technology, also author of Silent Victims, Hate Crimes Against Native Americans. Professor, thanks for being here.
Happy to talk with you.
Well, you're hearing Rahima Nassi describe this case in Washington, the case of Jimmy Smith Kramer. Are you hearing strains that are familiar as you've gone about your research and your reporting for your book?
It certainly does resonate with what I was hearing when I was doing interviews with Native Americans across the country some years ago. What I'm hearing is from many communities, but especially the Native American community, that, again, their victimization in the context of hate crime specifically is not taken seriously. They're often told that they are overreacting, that they're looking for racial motivation where there is none, rather than acknowledging that it is an extension of a history of oppression and violence, systemic violence as well, as very direct physical violence, and the more contemporary patterns of really serious patterns of marginalization.
Now, in this case in Washington, Professor, the police and prosecutors did and are prosecuting this crime, first-degree manslaughter. It was the hate crime that they chose not to prosecute. And the community's reaction to that seems to speak to an experience of being slighted in their view or not taken seriously by law enforcement.
I think the justice system, as was suggested, don't understand that the sense, the depth of that feeling of indignation and indignity that this signals to them.
I mean, does this case with Jimmy Smith Kramer and the testimony or at least the police statements of the other kids at that incident sound indicative to you? I mean, this is one of the difficulties with hate crime statutes is that they do rely on establishing motive, right? And in this case, the kids testify that the driver did say words that might indicate a hate crime. In many other cases, it can be difficult to get inside someone's head.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the speech, the language used here is very important for contextualizing the incident. It seems that if we take those youth's testimony seriously, that there's no question that there was that motivation, particularly to drive over someone twice, suggests some form of intent to harm.
Professor, looking forward to solutions, it's very difficult to look into one case. More broadly, though, looking toward a solution, do you have ideas about how law enforcement, police, and prosecutors can use these laws more effectively when it comes to Native Americans?
Well, I think one of the issues, it boils down to training and to knowledge about how to proceed with these sorts of cases. It's a challenge. I mean, can you call in expertise? Can you bring in special prosecutors when we have hate crime offenses? I think that's an option. Same thing with law enforcement. Are there officers trained within these jurisdictions to respond to hate crime, to recognize it, to know how to investigate it effectively?
Barbara Perry is professor at University of Ontario and author of Silent Victims. Professor Perry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Rahima Nassa, reporting fellow at ProPublica's Documenting Hate Project. Rahima, thanks to you as well.
Thank you so much.
And that's all for us today. Thanks so much for being with us this hour. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.
Hey guys, it's Tanzina Vega, and I can't wait to get started as your next host on May 7th. But before then, I want to hear from you. What do you want me to cover on The Takeaway? Who would you like me to interview? And what stories aren't getting covered that you think we should? Our producers are compiling your suggestions so we can hit the ground running. Tweet me at Tanzina Vega or call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Talk to you soon.